Yeah, so I really want to donate $1 million to a good cause.
$1 million? That's a lot of money. You have that kind of money?
No, but I really want to have the kind of money that would make me want to donate $1 million to a good cause. That's what I'm kind of saying.
I hear you. Yeah, that'd be nice to have that kind of dough. I mean, I've got like $20. I'll kick in.
Okay.
Then we only need, what, 999? Oh, wait a minute. Hold on a second. We're rolling.
All right, well, then let's roll. Well, I'm Rich.
And I'm Mark.
And we are two guys on Block Island. What shall we do with the sailor? What shall we do with the shark? All right, I'm going to do the intro here. So, you know, this is a guest that I've seen in passing over and over and over, and just never somebody I got to know that well. So yeah. I'm kind of excited to have a guest like that. I don't even have that many notes. So
I've apparently met our guest before, but I have to apologize. I didn't remember.
That happens a lot.
It does.
So our guest is Claire Costello.
Hello again, Claire.
Yeah. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
Yeah.
Claire, you are wearing a sweatshirt that says Daydreamer on it.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
I try to make it accurate. I'm kind of in my head a lot, so if I can daydream, it's a good thing.
Yeah, me too.
Great. Well, I can't wait to get in there with her.
Yeah, let's.
Oh, be careful what you wish for.
I'm not afraid of anything. There's only been a couple of heads I've been in that I was.
Jill Helterlein once told me I had more in my head than the Sunday Times. So, so mine away.
Well, that's good. At least there's no shortage of conversation about to happen then.
No, I don't think we're going to have a problem.
Cool.
You know, one of the things that I noticed was, I'm just going to be transparent, and I always kind of, for many, many years, I just thought you were like some summer person, and I would see you every summer, and you'd say hi, and then I just realized, my gosh, he's here all the time, and then I started hearing stories from some of our other guests about you,
yeah.
You know, you being there for a lot of fun and shenanigans, and so tell us, you know, when did you first come to Block Island, and how'd you get here, and how'd you end up staying, kind of?
Well, I first came in the mid-60s, so I was a wee one, and my dad came through a friend of his, which is kind of how it went back then. And so, you know, everybody kind of fell in love, as one does. And we bought a house pretty quickly. And
your parents did.
My parents did. Yeah, I was only, you know, 6 or 7.
So you didn't have to chip in at that time.
I didn't really have the bucks at the time. Still don't. But anyway, so we kind of began there. Sold a house, rented houses, built a house, which my brother now lives in down the neck. And that's the way it all began. And I always spent a disproportionate amount of my time here.
And where was home base?
Home base was initially Westchester, New York,
okay.
Which you can probably relate to.
Sure.
And then
in name, title.
In name only.
Yeah.
And then ultimately New York City. But I always had one foot here, even when I was fully employed in New York in the 80s, for example. That's when I started the Committee for the Great Salt Pond with my good friend John Brotherhood. So I always had more energy here, even if I didn't have my toothbrush here all the time.
Yeah. Well, I always describe it as I would go back for school when I was in high school and stuff, and the whole time just thinking about getting back here, you know, that's where your mind was. Yeah. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
And so you were 6 years old, you spent summers here.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you started working here during the summers at some
my
point?
My first job was sweeping the spring house porch with a broom that was bigger than I was.
was that when Doug?
Doug had it. Yeah. Doug and Candy had it.
Yep.
And then I graduated when I was old and responsible enough to ride a bike. I graduated to working for Dorothy Sullivan, who was the precursor to the namesake for Sullivan Real Estate. And I used to drive around with these manual typewritered index cards that said, you know, empty your garbage and whatever you had to do.
Yep.
And I would thumbtack them into the walls of all her rentals above the sink.
Ah.
So that was my second big job. I think I was probably 9 or 10.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, so you were the ride along, obviously, not driving yet.
No, I was on my bike.
Oh, you did this
on
your bicycle?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You would bike around the island.
I would bike around to her rentals.
Cards.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, dare I ask what that paid? Probably $3 a day.
It was the glory of it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, free agent earning coin on my bike. Please.
Yeah.
At 9.
Yeah. Yeah, probably 9 or 10, you know, something like that.
And then what? Then what were the other
did you
job?
Always spend, so your family, once they went from when you were little, full summers here?
Yeah. We left once in a while. We went to camp. There were a few stints in camp.
Yeah.
And I did a year one summer living with cousins lifeguarding on the mainland. So, but the vast, those were the exception. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I was here.
And then into your teenage years, which, yeah.
Whoa.
This sounds good.
So let's see. So my first, I guess, legit job was working for Doug and Candy at the Spring House. I was a waitron there for 3 years. And back then, the way it worked was you never had a day off because, you know, parties would come for a week or 10 days or whatever it was. And they were assigned or you were assigned to them for the duration of their stay.
Oh, so it was still like the shore dinner was included with your stay.
Yeah, exactly. You got your breakfast and dinner. Yeah. And then penance was lunch every 3 or 4 days, which nobody came to do because we only had grilled cheese and tuna. And what you ended up doing was polishing the silverware and washing the windows. Like literally, it was just, but you had to be there by no later than 6 or 6:30. And we would sit on the hill, which is now the patio, and watch the sunrise in our baby blue aprons. And there was quite a rivalry because the Gansett, which they also owned, had pink aprons. So it was like the blue apron and the pink apron. And Pam Littlefield and her sister worked at the Gansett, and they lived farther north than I did on the neck. And I was usually on my bike. And so they would come up the neck in their pink aprons and pick me up in my blue apron and drop me off because they always had what we called the cougar. The purple convertible. So anyway, so I worked there for I think 3 years. And
some days did you have to do like breakfast and dinner?
You did breakfast and dinner every day.
Oh, every day.
Every day. Every day. And every third or fourth day you did lunch.
And if you didn't have to do lunch, did you go home or just go for a swim?
You went
or
to the beach and you passed out and waited for dinner. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it was So one day, it was really a very memorable conversation. Doug and Candy came to me and they said that my disposition, I still don't know how to take this, but that my disposition
<We'll tell you.
laughs> was better suited for a bar room than the waitron floor. And would I be interested in bartending at Dead Eyes?
That's a compliment.
And I had, you know, I had just become of drinking age. At the time, drinking was 18.
Okay.
The good old days.
So I didn't know a rye from a scotch from a whatever. So I said, sure. And so the following year, freshly of age, I went down to bartend at Dead Eyes, the old Dead Eyes, the, you know, Billy Stubbs Dead Eyes.
Oh, you were there when Billy played.
Oh, yeah. Every year. Wow. And Margie staged all of that. And it was a phenomenal place to, you know, break in because you had the pre-dinner crowd. Well, no, excuse me. You had the after-dinner quarter drafts that the bar was lined with everyone you know and love for a quarter a draft. And then they would gently go home and the pre-dinner crowd would come in waiting for their tables and waiting for their fellow guests and have pre-dinner cocktails. And then, of course, you serve the dining room. And then it digressed into the evening. And you had like
digressed.
Each one of those phases was a different genre of cocktail. So for a novice, it was trial by fire.
Wow.
And the other aspect of it, which I hadn't foreseen, was that it was a boys' club. No woman had ever dared to pour there. And it was a thing. And I'm from a family of all brothers and all male cousins, except for one, like huge tribe of male siblings and extended family. And I had never really appreciated what it was like to kind of
wow.
So I, you know, little things like, you know, somebody's wife would call and say, is he there? And I'd say, oh, sure, he's right here, when I didn't realize that you don't do that, right? You say, oh, no, I haven't seen him. And
Bob who?
Exactly. So there were a few of those. And there are several people still living among us that quit drinking on my watch. I don't know to what extent I was responsible for that. But they're sober to this day. God bless them.
They were just like, well, there's a female bartender now. There goes the neighborhood. I'm done with this.
It was fun. I mean, it was not really an issue. And, you know, outwardly, everyone got along. And I knew all the people that I was, you know, shutting down. But it was a different lens, shall we say.
Sure. You know, perhaps they were perceptive enough to pick up on you had been, you know, raised in a household of all men and you had that thicker skin to deal with men, and that's why, you know, you were the first female.
But it was good fun. It was really, really good fun. And I worked there for 3 years, and there were two bartenders at all times, and Little Joe Do you all remember Little Joe? He was the day bartender.
I don't.
His name was Harry because he used to go, ar-ar-ar-ar-ar-ar-ar-ar. So we all called him Harry.
Did he end up at the Highview at some point with Marilyn Wolfie up there? Like,
no, I think he died, you know, from death. Not, that sounded really terrible. I didn't mean that. But like, I think he was an older gentleman. And I
it's
think
a fact. It's, you know,
and
it's
I think
a...
his last gig was, but it was classic because he used to sleep in the liquor storeroom upstairs. So if you were at bartending at night and you needed, you know, backup, you'd have, and there was Harry or Joe, like prone on the bed in his boxers.
Wait a minute. So he actually, you don't mean he would go up there to take a nap?
No, he
would.
He lived there. That was his room
in the liquor storeroom.
Well, I think the liquor storeroom was his bedroom. I think
I was
the bedroom
say, maybe
came
they,
first.
Maybe yeah. they stored okay, the liquor okay, in his
yeah,
room.
Yeah, I think it was the other way around. But it was a classic setup. So you'd have to like tiptoe in, buy a little.
Oh my God.
You draw straws. I'm not going to get more
going
bourbon.
In there.
So, yeah, there were two of us at all times. And,
did he sleep in his underwear?
He did. He slept in boxers. Oh, and he slept on his back, as I recall.
Oh, my God. Who were some of the characters?
It's the details.
Who were the regulars at the bar?
Oh, well, there was Margie.
Yeah.
Who, fun story, when she left Block Island, finally, you know, she had quite a selection of really fine wigs, which I didn't appreciate, are really expensive.
Oh, yeah.
And they were red and voluptuous. And she was also quite famous for her blinking port starboard earrings, green and red, obviously. And she would come in with her high hair, higher the hair, closer to God, she used to say, and her blinking earrings. And what song did... Billy used to break out in a certain song. At any rate.
Here Comes the Bride?
No. But when she left, she said, "Dear, could you come see me at the store?" You know, kind of thing. And I went over and she bequeathed to me her wigs.
Really?
Which I was like, are you sure? Because I think you have the wrong person. But at the same time, I was so honored because they were so much of her identity and I knew they were really expensive. And she gave me her port and starboard earrings.
Wow.
Which I wore all of the above in several of the Committee for the Great Salt Pond debutante ball fundraisers.
Do you still have them?
I probably do somewhere.
Somewhere.
I've moved three times since, so I don't know. I used to have a stash for the dead ball / Halloween, so I may have it.
Was she a visitor to Block Island, or did she have a shop or something?
No, she had the shop right where, what's there now? It was Sean's shop. It was Block Market, but now he's moved. But it was that little...
Next to the Empire?
Yeah, and she... Yeah. It was Margie's stage door, and she was famous for the handwritten signs in the door, like one I remember on a piece of cardboard with a Sharpie, you know, "For whoever stole the bottom of the bikini, could you please bring it back so I could sell?" Like she was, it was a classic store. It was all kind of a mishmash of her hand-me-downs and some thrifty stuff, some new stuff. And it was like walking into someone's closet. It was, you know, with this classic woman who, you know, her eyelashes were from here to eternity. I mean, she was just an amazing person. She was a legit vaudeville person.
Larger than life.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. So she was a character regularly, and Billy, of course, was a character. Whenever we were ready to go home, I'd give Billy the, and he'd sing God Bless America, and everyone would stand up so that everyone would then leave because they were on their feet. That was always
that was half the battle.
Right.
Get them off the stool. I know
then,
what to do.
Then there was Gertie, who always used to sing, Billy used to sing Lovely Bunch of Coconuts, and she would jostle her breasts and sort of, and then predictably she would sit back down, wet the chair, and then when it was time to go home and clean up, you always knew where Gertie sat because you had to
clean. Oh, you got to be kidding me.
No, it was a thing.
Wow. Was Gertie a good tipper?
I don't think Gertie knew where what was up. She was such a good sport, and she and Marg were kind of like a tag team. You know, they were... But it was, and then there were, of course, the, you know, the Madras shorts kind of sailor people who themselves were their own caricature. And it was just this.
We call them Chads nowadays.
Oh, Chads. Okay. They were Chads, but they were like, they were having a great time. And, you know, they were just, everything was flowing.
Yeah.
The liquor was flowing. The dollars were flowing. It was all good. You know, everyone was just, it was like an adult, you know, romper room.
Yeah.
It was just all good.
What was Billy Stubbs like as a guy?
Oh, he was a gem. He was a superb. He downed at least a bottle of Cuddy a night. At least. I don't know where he put it because he was a man of small stature.
Yeah.
But boy, did he was a human sponge. It was remarkable.
And what do you mean a human's like?
That what he imbibed. I mean, even from a bartender standpoint, it was like the true hollow leg.
Yeah.
You know, consumption.
Must have something to do with piano players. I have the same problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit.
You can do it for a man of small
stature.
But
he was a good guy and he was always upbeat and happy and he just loved what he did and it came out of his pores and you know, out of his fingers and it was really fun.
And what was his saying? Who dat, right?
Who dat? Who dat? And then he'd slap and he laughed and laughed and he guffawed and you know, he just I don't know. And even though he played the same songs plus or minus, he did take requests. But, you know, you never tired of them. And he always had little sort of lyrical twists that he would like, you know, Pennies from Heaven. And he would add his own little Billy-isms in there to sort of make sure people were listening. And everyone knew the songs and everyone was singing along. And it was really fun.
Yeah. I did a tribute to him.
I saw it.
Were you there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was a blast.
That was really great.
I forget who gave me the tapes. And they
I think Stan Balas has them.
Stan had them. Yeah.
I know he's got some pictures of those days, and somebody else had them. But that was
the recordings are great because you can hear everything in the background. You can hear, you know, the Deadeyes going off like crazy.
Yeah,
yeah.
The acoustics in there were so loud in there all the time.
Yeah,
it still is.
Yeah, I was gonna say it still is. Hard floor, hard ceiling.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
I love that we're like, you know what, like 15 minutes into this thing and we're still on our bartending job at Deadeyes. It's amazing.
So that was Deadeyes, and then 3 years in, Ed was managing Nick's.
Ed McGovern.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so, he invited me to work, and I said sure. And
And this was Nick's as it is now, or was it the Block Island Inn?
No, it was as it is now.
So here, okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was the Nick's where when you rung up a drink, you got an electric shock because the plumbing was connected to the electric.
Yeah, that hasn't changed.
Yeah, yeah. That was...
yeah.
Yeah, it was that Nick's.
Why is my bartender wearing rubber gloves?
Yeah. And why are all of the bartender's hair standing on end? Yeah.
So it's
a wig.
What were your days like here at Nick's?
Well, my first day was probably the most memorable. I don't know if this is fit for prime time.
Oh, it's fine.
Yeah.
No?
Okay. Well, I'll see if I can.
Let's see if you can dance around it. Yeah. You're a lawyer, right?
So, well, we're recovering.
Okay.
It was my first night, and I was behind the bar setting up. It was early yet. And Nick, affectionately known as the Dark Cloud at that time, DC for short, came. And he had a jet black cat, and he was standing in front of the bar, and he was sort of psychotically stroking the cat.
Like a James Bond villain, call it.
Like creepier.
Oh.
And and he looks up, and Ed was on the other side of the bar with him, and I'm behind the bar, and he looks at Ed as if I'm not there and says, "Who's the F and C behind the bar?"
Wow.
Yeah, huh? Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Ed said, "That would be your new employee, Nick." It's like, thanks for giving him the heads up, Ed.
Wow. Yeah, well, I heard.
But let me fast forward out of fairness. Like, fast forward, I don't know, 5+ years, maybe less. We were at some event at Ballard's, the old Ballard's, the Jim Kelly Ballard's.
Yes.
And there were Nick and I dancing cheek to cheek to some kind of slow ballad. So we came a long way, Nick and I.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard Nick could be rough around the edges at times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that was his filtering process.
Right.
I think that
start
was
out
just...
hard.
Yeah.
And if they tolerate that,
right.
Everything gets...
Like an initiation process.
You can't get
of.
Meaner than that.
Right.
Like, it's only going to get better from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And was this now... What years was this then?
So, oh, gosh. Math. Okay.
Was this still like the dirt floor Nick's?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, it was the wooden floor. That covered the... plumbing, because of course there was no plumbing, so it went directly under the dance floor,
right.
Which explains the concrete floor of today.
Yes.
Wow. What a nice intro.
Any other good Captain Nick
James
stories?
Bond. I'm still stuck on worse. Like a James Bond villain? Oh no, much creature. Like
that's. We just had, you know, it was a great run. It was me and the boys again. Yeah. And, you know, we had our share of bar fights and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And it, you know, it was just fun. It was funny.
Yeah.
And of course, bars were open till two then.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
And then
right.
you clean up yeah. and, you know, and you could smoke. So
right.
you smelled like an ashtray. So, you know, and there tended to be some regular bands. So the bands were like another dimension of our closing time because they were the same band, the same guys.
Yeah.
Very few women again. And so we all would like hang and, you know, clean glasses. And then, of course, you had to wash the filth. So we would go to Fresh Pond or the ocean, depending on the wind and such. So, yeah. So if you got home by four, it was a good thing.
Yeah.
And I had a day job. So, because I worked myself through school twice. And so, you know, I'd get some shut eye and I'd get up. And one of my day jobs was working at the big with Clara Phillips. You know, she had the long brown, what were those brown?
Really the Moors.
Long, the Moors.
The Moor cigarettes.
She chain smoked Moors at the register. Clara Phillips and Claire. That was the two at the register. So I had that for a while. I did another retail store. Rob Helterlein had in the Fish Head before it was Kimberly's, had like a...
The Shoreline, right?
No. Jill had that. This was years before. He had like a scuba gear... kind of rubber balls, like play things. It didn't last long. And then I drove a cab for George Milliken after he hit his second or third stone wall. God love him. It was time. But, you know, I was happy to do it because the income was still flowing their way. And
yeah.
it was fun. I did get beat up in the cab once, though.
That Wait,
was
what? Like, what? Really? Actually?
Oh, yeah. It was really true.
How did that happen?
It's kind of funny, actually.
Oh, how on earth?
Well, what happened was, I was driving. It was at night, and I was coming down Ocean Avenue, and there were sort of like a pack of guys running up Ocean Avenue, and I'm thinking in my naivete, oh wow, people must be really waiting for cabs because
yeah, they're in a hurry,
they're sprinting up, you know, to catch me. And as they approach, it becomes clear that one of the guys was in the front of the pack being chased. And so he jumps in my driver's seat. And before I can even blink, the rest of them are like on the hood of the car. And he starts locking the doors. But my driver window was open a bit. So the guys start pummeling him through me, like over me. And I was wearing glasses. And I remember they broke my glasses, like they kind of got all gnarly. And the guy that got in the car, my foot was on the brake. I didn't even have a chance to put the car in park. So the guy wants me to drive, but I would take down the whole group in front of me. So he is pulling on my foot to get it off the brake and put it on, and like pulling on my pants leg, and my pants rip all the way up to my... And I was like, what is this? And I remember the irony of it was that I had just dropped off these two salty guys at Payne's, and they're like, you know, the classic chauvinistic, like, what's a fine girl like you driving a camera?
Yeah, yeah,
and I was like, oh yeah, it's no big deal out here. And the very next minute, I'm driving down Ocean Avenue and I'm getting beat up. And so
you're like, don't you know I'm an FNC?
So I start screaming. And what's his name? Rob, who lived in Stinton lives in front of Sears' little house where Kirk lived for a little while, or Russell lived, whatever.
Oh, yeah, the one they raised up.
The raised up one.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So Rob, what's his name? He had an earring, and he had curly, short brown hair. Oh, he was a great guy.
Go with Rob.
Okay, Rob. Anyway, I start screaming such that I wake him up. And meanwhile, the cops were driving. Paul Riker was driving a cab. Vin Macklin was driving a cab. Somebody else.
But no radios yet?
There were, but I couldn't get to my radio.
Oh, geez.
So I rake Rob up just from screaming. And so he calls it in, says there's somebody screaming, but they couldn't get my location. And so anyway, long story short, they got the... And Billy McComb was recently named the police chief. And I had known him for a very long time prior to then, when he was managing the Harborside and so forth for the Pratts. And so I had just gotten, my hair was really long and I had just cut it really short and my glasses were all, and my pants were half off. And so I get out of the car and he says, not recognizing me apparently. So I'm missing a piece. So all the cabs swarmed, including the off-duty cops and retired cops and so forth. And so Billy McComb shows up and he says to one of his fellow officers, take this young lady up to the station and get her a Coke. And I just burst out laughing. I'm like, I want a Coke. Like, anyway, it was very funny. And that was, yeah, that was my cab story.
So did they get the guys? Were the guys
they got them.
They
I don't know what happened. Oh, they had to give me restitution. They had to pay for my glasses and my pants.
It seems like they got off easy.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Although we don't know, back in those days, there was always a little back room sometimes.
Yeah, I don't know what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if they had further charges, but I know that's what I had to do.
They may have gotten their glasses broken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Anyway.
Scary, though.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was. And so then all the other cab drivers gave me a new handle. They started calling me a Vander.
Hasn't Hollyfield?
Yeah, that was
Hollyfield.
Yeah, that was my new handle.
Wow, that's crazy.
That was my cab driving career.
Now, so in your timeline at this point in time, are you already attending school and working here in the summers? Or
yeah, I'm attending school. I don't know whether I was in undergraduate or graduate school at that point, but I was always here. Like even in graduate school, I kind of took the correspondence course, and when I was in law school, your law school books are just ginormous, and it was a purely bodybuilding exercise for me, and I would just carry them back and forth. And I would find, funny story, Roy Fowler's a good friend of mine, and when I'd be out here in the winter, he would swing by or what have you, and I would find him reading my law books. And long story short, he got so into it, he went to law school.
Yeah,
he
really?
Became a lawyer, yeah. Yeah. No way. Say, he's a lawyer.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow, so you inspired him.
I would like to think. I don't know if I did, but he did more of my homework than I did by just reading the books, you know.
Oh, yeah. He's a good motorcycle mechanic, too.
He's a phenomenal motorcycle mechanic. Yeah.
Wow.
Who's he's this? A genius.
Roy Fowler, it's Scott's brother.
Scott's brother.
Okay. Yeah. Is he out here?
No,
I haven't seen him in years.
He grew up right here.
Okay.
His parents own.
Wow. Yeah.
He was out a lot in the younger years. You'd see him here and there.
Gotcha. Okay.
I called him when we got robbed, and they caught the kid who ripped us off at the restaurant.
He went on to, he worked as a prosecutor and a public defender and for the corrections department, and now he's retired.
Wow. Yeah.
I asked him, I said, what if we don't make him give back the $5,000 and we just prefer to have him put in jail? He's like, that's not how it works. It's all at all costs. We're trying to keep people out of the prison system. Yeah. Like, all right, fine. We'll take the money back.
So where'd you go to school?
I went to Amherst College in Western Mass.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
I went to UMass.
Oh, you did?
I know Amherst.
Oh, yeah.
I grew up in Agawam right down the road.
Oh, okay, cool.
So I'm from Western Mass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't love it because it was, I was early in the co-ed process and the frat system was raging.
Okay.
And the alcohol was obscene. And
yeah.
It's a whole different place. Like I rode crew and we would get the men's bathtub hand-me-down shells and they got these sleek alumni purchase like fiberglass. It was pretty bad.
Yeah.
It was pretty bad.
Lots of Chads up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And way before they've made it all.
And now
what's the code now? There's a code where it has to be and should be equal between male and female sports.
Yeah. Like Title IX you're talking
Title
about.
Title IX, yeah. Title
yeah.
IX.
I mean, and it was a phenomenal education. So let me say that out loud because, it's a very well-regarded school and I don't mean to be trashing it on public airwaves, but the experience, I came from a New York City public school and going into that was like,
whoa. Wow.
So I spent a lot of time getting gone. I did a lot of work. I took a lot of classes at UMass just for the diversity of it all and just to be able to kind of look at different people.
Yep.
And you said correspondence, because that was back in the day where through the mail, right? You had
No. I was joking, meaning I was here. So
oh, okay.
I was here and not.
I was
on,
like, that's kind
not,
of a feat.
Not on campus. No, not on campus.
Yeah.
So people, but no, I was, I liked going to class.
And did you know you wanted to become a lawyer as an undergrad? Were you like pre-law or did you decide?
There was
you
no
like,
real,
hey,
no, I did. I actually took a couple of years off before I went to law school just to look at various jobs that I never would do. I looked at some business. I worked at some business corporate jobs and so forth. And then I went to NYU Law, which was where I wanted to go because they had a really strong emphasis on clinical education. So instead of just reading pages 1 through 1,000 for tomorrow, it was all, it had a practical component. It was, you had real clients early on and you worked through clinics and workshops and it was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And so I went there. And then I practiced law for a while. Oh, no, then I clerked for a federal judge in Boston for a trial judge. So I was in court every day doing jury work and so forth. And then I became a litigator in NYC.
Wow.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was good sport, you know? I mean, it was fun. I mean, I like the stand up, think on your feet, kind of, again, jury work. I like trying to read the room. My bartending was so helpful for that. I can't even tell you. It was all about, you know.
Did you wear those earrings, the green and red?
And the wigs?
What? And the wigs, this, just to throw them off.
Yeah.
The suspect to my port side.
Yeah.
No, I was a knapsack. I carried a knapsack, a bright red knapsack, years before people carried knapsacks in the business context.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I remember one day early on in court, my client, the judge called my case and said to my client, "Is your attorney here?" And my client pointed to me and said, "Yes, Your Honor." And he said, "Oh, the knapsack attorney." And I was like, "Yep."
You had a nickname, the knapsack attorney.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
that's the name of my next film.
The knapsack attorney. Did you ever have get to have a Tom Cruise, A Few Good Men moment where, you know, you can't handle it, where you got, had someone on, you were, you know, questioning the witness or something, and you were like,
I don't know
if
I had.
Tricked him into.
Yeah. I don't know if I had that level of drama. Maybe they experienced it that way.
Okay.
But
it's a good point.
You know, I don't know. I certainly witnessed that when I worked in the federal court system with a trial judge. There was a lot of that.
Really?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
A lot of objection and adjournment and cooling of heads and all of that. Oh yeah, for sure.
Wow.
And I argued in front of now Justice Sotomayor.
Really?
Yeah. I argued a case and won in front of her. It was a contract case. These two brothers hated each other to the bone, and they were suing the living bejesus out of each other. I forget why, though. I think they were in business together. I don't know what it was, but anyway, she wanted none of it. So it was great. But ultimately, you know, for all the blood, sweat, and tears it takes to be a trial attorney, because your schedule, you know, you get called for trial and your vacation is like too bad, so sad. And, you know, your trial work is like, it's like preparing for exams every other month. You know, I wasn't disenchanted with the practice of law, but it didn't blow my skirt up as high as it ought to have for what it sapped from me.
Yeah.
And so it was during this time that I started the Committee for the Great Salt Pond. And
we got
the federal discharge. So I was really focused here. And I left the practice of law a couple times. I did a year plus study for McKinsey & Company looking at the intersection between tourism and sustainability. And I had the really tough jurisdiction of the Caribbean and Central America. So I spent a lot of time in Costa Rica and St. Lucia and stuff, working with like the World Bank, trying to value a macaw to the economy so as to be able to convince the Ministry of Forestry and the Ministry of Finance that they ought to be talking to each other. That, in other words, for example, at the time there was a policy that valued land higher if you clear cut it than if you didn't, which worked counter to the ultimate long game for that area, because if you preserved your forest, you would then have more macaws, for example. I'm oversimplifying this. And then you would have greater tourism and it would sustain your economy for the long term.
Right.
So it was,
I don't kill what people want to come and see.
Yeah. So it was the very early days of what they now call ecotourism, which is a huge industry.
Yeah.
But
I think this week's BI, I don't know when this is going to play, but the Times covers it. They're doing studies on the tourism and Block Island's effect.
Right, the sustainability.
The sustainability,
yeah. How you play the long game and how you convince people now to not go for the more expedient,
the quick buck.
Expedient, right. And when you're trying to sort of move governments and policy, it was, anyway, so I did that for a little bit. And then that was like a consortium of the World Bank and TNC, Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, World Wildlife Fund. Ford Foundation was backing it. And I think MacArthur was in there too. Anyway, it was a really cool group of people. So I did that, but that was just sort of a project. So that took me away. And then I left again later and helped set up the first urban Nature Conservancy office, which was in New York City, in the heart of Times Square, where all endangered species live.
Well, some do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was in there, too. So I had some fits and starts. But and then ultimately, I said, you know what? This is just not bringing me the joy. It's not making the world spin any better. Like, my client may be happy or not at the end of the day, but like, the world's not better for my effort. So I quit cold turkey.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow was right. I was like,
Because, yeah, the dough must have been pretty good. You're making some money.
Yeah,
and like,
it's not my thing. Yeah. I mean, I guess, but it's, that's not my carrot.
Yeah.
So anyway, I ended up talking my way into a job at a major private bank, convincing the CEO that they really needed a philanthropy division, because one of the most meaningful aspects of wealth is giving your money away. And he's behind the eight ball and he needs to get with the program, and he bought it.
Wow.
Nice.
And so I started a global philanthropic advisory service for this very boutique private bank that had 2/3 of its client base was non-US. So I was all over the world helping people figure out what they care about, and then secondly, what to do about what they care about.
Wow. Wow.
And it was a really good gig.
That's a pretty neat job. To help people and help people help people.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So like what was it like working? I mean, because you must have worked with some of the most powerful people in the world.
People that you would know.
Yeah.
And maybe vote for president or not. Or
wow.
Or you
not
know,
both of us, because we vote for different.
Watch on TV.
Or, what's it like?
And titans of industry.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
People who owned, you know, the banking system in their country and you know, in you know, the Arabic countries, the princes and such.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. So what's it like? I mean, peeking behind the curtain of like the global power elite. I mean, that's got to be,
you know,
a little wild.
It is a little wild. I'm not one to kind of really be wowed by princes or paupers. To me, they're all kind of, because the level that I deal with and to this day still do this work, it's the human level. You know, it's what's your legacy? What keeps you up at night? What do you want to, what gets you out of bed in the morning? You know, what do you want for yourself, for your kids, for your community? You know, how do you put worth to this wealth? And what's it all for?
Yeah.
Other than counting it, what's it all for? And, you know, if your alarm didn't go off tomorrow, what would you do?
Yeah.
And why would you do that? And it's so, when you're talking with folks on that level, it doesn't matter who you are.
Right.
It doesn't, frankly, even matter how much money you have.
Yep.
It's how you leverage it toward the greater good, however you define that. So my mission is, by definition, their mission. And so, you know, a lot of my job is practicing psychology without a license.
Yeah.
Nice.
Trying to get at, you know.
Again, back to the bartending.
Yeah, the service industry. Yep. We've talked about it a bunch.
Oh, yeah.
It's a and being in part of a big family and living in a city and all that stuff and traveling, you really learn to develop your radar system pretty well.
Yeah.
That's what I, so then I left. I had a health battle in there in the middle of that. So the corporation kind of imploded, as they do kind of perennially. So after, I don't know, 5 years, I guess, I took a break and I was doing it on my own from here. I was, so this would be in the maybe 2000, something like that. So I was consulting and working for big and small donors and big and small nonprofits.
When did you transition to more time here? Like, how did
then
that go?
I traveled so much that when I wasn't traveling, I was here.
Well, yeah.
So,
I mean, now in a typical year, how long?
Well, COVID, you know, shut everything down. But before COVID, I was probably traveling. Well, at this point, at that first job, I was probably traveling 70% of my time.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a lot.
And so did you have an apartment or somewhere?
I had a crash pad on the mainland, and but I was here when I could be still. And then when I was on my own, I worked from here entirely. And then when I took the job doing similar stuff, I was recruited into right when the market crashed. So I guess like 2007 or 8.
Yep.
I took refuge. I got pitched a job and I thought, you know, I probably should not work for myself right now. So I went on board. in a similar situation. And I, and again, I travel, you know, when I, one of the conditions was like, yeah, I'll take the job, but I live here. And they're like, that's cool. So I, you know, I go where I need to go when I need to go, meeting with clients and meeting with grantee organizations and site visits and such. But, this business is much more domestic than my previous. So, the client base is not as international, so I don't really have to go that far if I do go. So, yeah, I'm here.
But are you still traveling that much?
No, I'm just it's just post-COVID. It's just starting up. Okay. So I'm traveling 10% of my time right now.
Wow. Do you miss the extensive travel, or did you like it?
I loved it when I was doing that kind of travel, because I was, you know, on the ground in Mozambique, and I was, you know, on the ground in just places I would never have had access to, if I didn't have that purpose and the cachet that my clients brought to the moment. But now traveling's different, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's much more strenuous, maybe because I'm that much older, but also it's just gross. It's packed and dirty, and the flights are full, and everyone's coughing and might have COVID, and so no.
Right,
I don't
they're
like
on it. They're on the upswing of starting to supply more and more seats because there's a growth going on right now, you know, getting people back to traveling in general. So
yeah,
hey, I am intrigued. But maybe we take a quick break for our sponsors.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Good time to do that. You don't mind? Can you hold on for just a minute while we do that? And we're going to listen to our sponsors, and then we'll be back with more Claire, because I'm intrigued.
I really am also intrigued. Yeah. We'll be right back.
Hey, before we go to commercial, I think this is a good time to talk about something that's super important to us. You know?
It's a big thing, and it's hard to talk about. And we're talking about, of course, mental health.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can quickly share that I have been in a very bad place myself. And, you know, I don't know how I got there or why it was happening.
I mean, I've been there as well, Rich. We've talked about it. I think both of us on the podcast, both of us have been, you know, in bad places at times. The tough thing is you don't know how to explain it to anybody.
Yeah. And you feel like you're being a whiner, you know, because sometimes things are bad in your head, but on the outside, everything seems just hunky dory, you know?
And, everyone's life has been touched by losing someone to suicide. So we're working with the South County Health in a program called Zero Suicide, and we're hoping it makes a difference.
Yeah. So there's a great resource available there. It's a website called mantherapy.org. It is geared towards middle-aged men, but it doesn't mean you have to be a middle-aged man to utilize it, to learn. If you're a spouse or a coworker, you can, you know, send the link to someone else.
Yeah.
And, it's really a great site.
And you can use it to help get the ball rolling, and you don't have to talk to anybody at first. They have a 20-point head inspection, they call it, which would help you kind of, you know, make sense of things.
Yeah. And it's private in your own home, you know.
Yeah.
And while it's not a funny topic, the website takes, you know, just a great approach to it. They say things like, you know, sometimes a man needs a pork shoulder to cry on.
That's a good one.
When catching Z's is harder than catching a 20-pound trout.
I like it. I like the anxiety one. When stress grabs you by the balls. You know?
And there's so many more.
Yeah, they have a sense of humor. Yeah, which is nice.
So, you know, there's just too many great topics to read them all. So please go check it out. You know, there's no sense in waiting. Get it early. If it's starting to bug you or you think something's wrong, check it out.
Yeah. And the website again is mantherapy.org. Check it out and send it and share it with a friend.
Yeah. So we don't need to lose anyone to suicide or even have them living in a dark place. So please check it out, spread the word, and you never know, you might just save someone's life.
Hey, Rich, guess who I'm dressed as?
Let's see. You got crown, beard, trident. Are you a professional wrestler?
No, I'm King Neptune, duh.
Oh, sorry. King Neptune. Oh, you know what? The Neptune, that reminds me, I got some family coming out and they're going to stay up at the Neptune house.
Oh yeah, I love that place. They've got 23 modern condo style units, right?
Yeah, what's great is they've all got full kitchens with full size refrigerators. You know, maybe you don't want to eat out every night. You want to, you know, make something at home, or maybe you caught some fresh fish that day and you want to cook it on your own.
Right. You know what else? They've got great views and a heated pool, tennis courts, gas grills, picnic tables. They've even got a game room with a pool table for the kiddies.
Yeah. I mean, it's got everything you need to stay there and enjoy a great visit on Block Island. Sammy and the staff, they're always on hand. If you need anything, they're right there for you.
Sammy is so sweet and so nice. And you know what? The staff's great. And the best part is the location is awesome. You're tucked away from the hustle and bustle of downtown, but you're still a short walk to everything. The beaches, restaurants, you name it.
Yeah, I don't think there could be a better location. And, you know, they fill up quick in the summer, but the shoulder season is a great time to visit them as well. They rent the spring and fall. Check their website, NeptuneHouse.com.
Hey, Rich, do these bell bottoms make me look fat?
Bell bottom. Oh, wait. It must be Monday and you're going to disco night at Captain Nick's.
Well, yeah, of course I'm going to disco night at Captain Nick's. I'm the DJ, man. I got to be there.
That place is so much fun.
So much fun. And the fun doesn't end after Monday, because on Tuesday and Wednesdays, we have dueling pianos followed by Dr. Wes Chesterton's Sloppy Seconds.
What are Sloppy Seconds?
Well, that's when I play the piano for the rest of the drunk people there at the end of the night.
Oh, that sounds fun in itself. And Thursdays, they've got live acoustic acts and full bands and DJs.
Yeah. And Friday and Saturday afternoons, we have acoustic acts on the deck at 5:30. Fridays are Delaney, and then Saturdays are buddy Rob Davis.
And then Friday and Saturday nights, they've got the best live bands on Block Island, like Derek and the Fun Bags, the Blushing Brides, Fever, Neil and the Vipers, West End Blend, and the High and Mighty Brass Band, just to name a few.
Yeah, and the bands aren't over just because Friday and Saturday night ends. On Sunday afternoons, the Young Guns take the stage on the deck at 5:30.
Sunday fun day, and what if you're hungry? They got food. Food, right?
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So they've serving food out of the Captain Galley 7 days a week, including some late night grub. So, you know, if you're hungry, stop in late night and grab a bite.
Yeah. And if you want to check out the full entertainment schedule, let's just head over to CaptainNicksBI.com.
Whoa, whoa. What happened? What was that?
Ah, dude, I just ripped my favorite pair of jams. I've been wearing these things since 1987.
Don't panic. Just go on down and see Liz at the Traveling Seamstress.
Oh, yeah. I forgot Liz is here on the island. She repairs zippers. Yeah, she can do buttons. She can patch or mend most fabrics. You know what? She even can repair denim, so your favorite jeans can still be your favorite jeans.
That's nice. You know what else? If you're getting married, say yes to the dress, because she'll do last-minute alterations, steam and press tuxedo, or your suit. She pretty much can help you out with anything to do with your wedding.
Yeah, you know what I just remembered? She also makes curtains and draperies. She can do custom dye work. She can even make cushions for your home or your boat.
She is magic with the machine, let me tell you, because she does slip covers too. And no word of a lie, she did a set for my friend, and it's like walking into a different room with brand new furniture.
I actually flew a pair of pants over to her from the mainland over the winter to get taken up, and she did that too. And I didn't have to go to her place at 442 Dodge Street by the Four Corners.
Yep, and she keeps regular hours, May through November, you know, limited wintertime hours, but you could still reach her. You
sure.
Know.
And no project's too big or too weird.
Well, hey, you can follow her on Instagram at Traveling Seamstress.
Or you check out her website at TravelingSeamstress.com.
All right, and thank you to those sponsors. They help keep us going, and thanks for listening to them. We're back with Claire Costello, and we touched on it briefly, but you were responsible, co-founder of the Committee for Great Salt Pond. And tell us, how did that idea come about? Did something force that hand, or did you just decide it was a good idea?
No, it was kind of, you know, it was in reaction or response to what was happening. So back in 87, if I have that right.
We never check facts.
Ronowski. Yeah,
we're the opposite of lawyers.
Ronowski bought Dead Eyes. And it was not to run a restaurant as Jessica so ably does now, because Jessica was much younger then and probably didn't know she was going to go to culinary school and run a restaurant. But they bought it with the exclusive idea to put a ferry terminal in there.
And where Dead Eyes is?
Yeah, that was that was the new ferry terminal.
Oh, I didn't know
so
that.
So I believe there's two, there was Ronowski brothers, right? And
yes.
One does the current interstate navigation. The other one ran like a tugboat and...
the one is the New London.
Yeah. Right.
And the Point London. Jeff out of...
Yeah.
And the other one is right. Point Judith.
And they, I think one of them, I don't know, one of them also owns the dry docks and some tugs. And they're diversified in what they do, but they were brothers that overall...
Gotcha.
So... putting a ferry terminal in there had all sorts of implications, from dredging, and it would have to be dredged, you know, periodically and repeatedly. And it's right where the inner ponds kind of begin there. And there would be all sorts of landward implications as well if that was a ferry terminal with parking and loading and
right.
You know. So there were a lot of issues that kind of jumped out. And it was during the discussion period about permitting and zoning and all of that that John Brotherhood, who was a good friend of mine, and I were like, yeah, this doesn't seem right. And just to remind you of the context, back then you couldn't swim in the pond. It was too gross and dangerous. And
I did anyway.
And
it's so hard to resist jumping off the roof of Champlin's bar.
There. I hear that.
Yeah,
I hear that.
Yeah, I'd land on like a 1956 Chevy or
it
something.
It was more like
dumped in there.
A cross between diesel and poop.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Little,
no.
Little bowl.
It,
yeah.
It was that. Yeah. It Dupe. Was. Yeah. And Dupe. And you certainly couldn't eat out of the pond. There was no, you know, shell fishing and so forth. So we there was an island-wide campaign to kind of weigh in on the ferry construction, the terminal construction, and the pulse of the town was pretty much against it. And I can remember my dad wrote a letter that he copied me on and said, you too should write. And it was so prophetic because I ended up starting the Committee for the Great Salt Pond.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of opposition.
And thank you for that, by the way.
And the council, just to give you further context, was like Ed McGovern, first warden, Doug Michelle, second warden, Henry DuPont was in the mix. So there was a fairly progressive, proactive, not to suggest that the current council isn't, but there was a council that was amenable to, you know, improving and allocating resources towards this and so forth. So anyway, so John was, you know, he was an older guy and he was retired out here and he had like sort of a marketing mind and he was a really good kind of messenger, right? And I was more the strategy side and the networking side of it. And so together we kind of took this campaign against the ferry terminal and with closer inspection, it sort of revealed this whole agenda for the pond. And looking at it as it is today as an enterprise account that brings in as a non-enterprise, we wished it was, meaning that what the pond earns, the pond gets back, right? So building a visitor center or whatever is needed. But so this agenda about cleaning up the pond and shellfish and navigation and reclassification and so forth. So this whole agenda has just spun out from the work that we did. So we incorporated ourselves as a nonprofit and, we set about kind of cleaning up the pond. And one of the first things we tried to do was get a no discharge classification. And that's a federal classification. So it's pretty hard to get. And it requires that you not only clean up the pond to a certain level, but you demonstrate that you have the ability to keep it so. So that required that we launch a whole water testing program, which wasn't in place. And the Elwell family was kind enough to lend us, or give us, I should say, a boat, which we then converted into the first pump out boat. And we persuaded the council aforementioned to provide that service for free because we didn't think we'd get compliance otherwise. And again, compliance was pivotal to us getting the no discharge classification. So we worked hard on that. And around that time, development really started. So where the Sylvican property was, there were several owners. Don Huggins had it for a while. The Leonis had it for a while. And everyone had big development plans for it. And then the Ocean Avenue development that's there that Kelly Dusek put up, that's right on the inner pond, which they sort of PR'd ourselves out of a legal argument by saying it was going to be for elderly housing. And of course, it's not. So that got through from like a PR perspective. And then
if you look at it, I'm sorry to cut you off. You look at an aerial photo, it is amazing how many properties on Block Island, you know, touch the edge of the pond and those inner ponds. I mean, it's really an intricate waterway. And you don't think when I'm driving from the BIG to the fire station that, you know, until you know, and it's all right there.
So then there began to be a real proliferation of private docks jetting into the pond. So we did a build out study about if everyone who had dock rights built out, what it would look like and that impact on public shorelines and so forth. So we did a lot of so it became clear that there were some legal fights ahead of us. So I started a legal defense fund. That was kind of my bailiwick part of it as well. And interviewed a bunch of lawyers. And Dan Prentice was who we landed on. And he's still our super, super warrior attorney to this day, who's in his 18th year of the litigation about the Champlin's dock. God love him.
Wow.
We just lucked out. He's a superb human and a superb lawyer. And he's now also the lawyer for the town and the land trust and all that are part of that, and the BIC. who were part of that litigation. So he's been with us from the start. So I think we started the committee in like 87. I think we started the legal defense fund around 91-ish, and used it to fight Sylvegan development. We used it for Ocean Avenue. We used it for to stop any further private docks from being built around the shoreline. And there were several other developments around the pond that we either had restricted or denied. We helped reclassify the pond waters. So it's kind of confusing because we own the pond, that is to say the ground of the pond, but DEM has regulatory rights over the whole
water, you know, coverage,
moorings and construction, all that between DEM and CRMC. And so it's kind of a, so we need their permission to blink, you know, on the pond to float. And so working through them, we reclassified through the CRMC, the restricted, there are different categories of waterways which carry with them more restrictions. And we were able to redistrict the pond, so to speak, to concentrate the developed portions where you see it, where the marinas are, and keep the rec area open,
yeah,
and the inner,
like,
ponds
Andy's
open.
Way
and, right, yep. And all of that. So some of that was already in place, but we were able to redefine those areas. And then we worked from there toward an aquaculture program. We had joint research with URI, who used the pond for all sorts and still does for all sorts of research. And, you know, it's still humming along today, which is a beautiful thing.
And what was the initial cleanup process like? Like, how did you clean up the pond?
We cleaned it up with a lot of education. So I remember we would go out on the boats. We had these biodegradable plastic bags, and they were all sort of rules of the road, right? You know, rules of the pond, and don't use cleansers. And one was for recyclables, and one was for garbage. And we started to raise consciousness, and we threw our brochure out, and we put signs up at the marinas that said, use your head before you use your head.
And, that's a good one.
And part of our requirement for the no discharge was to have pump out stations at every marina. So as to encourage, as well as the, floating,
the boat. Yeah.
So we had to work with the marina operators. Some were more receptive than others, about getting mobile pump out stations or fixed stations at the dock. So we did a lot of that. And when you make it that easy to do, they'll do it. I mean,
it's hard to say no if it's like,
yeah. And
know.
Boaters, you know, they want to be able to jump off their boat,
yeah,
and swim and, you know, enjoy it. So
Would you say the biggest part of the cleanup was mostly stopping the continued dumping? Because pond has its natural way of cleaning itself up. I mean, it wants to. All the clams and stuff are natural filters, and, you know. So I mean,
it's not like we went out and vacuumed it or anything.
That's what I'm asking. Yeah, because I was thinking like the West Beach or the revetment, whatever they call it. Remember near the transfer station a couple of years ago where the erosion and all the trash was, the junk cars and everything were just spilling out.
Well, we did do that. So we also started the first beach cleanup. And I still have pictures of it. And I found them the other day when I was moving. And they're unbelievable. Like, we had something like 10 tons, 12 tons of garbage. It was the first organized beach cleanup, and we had teams do the whole island and the inner pond. We had tires. I mean, I have the count somewhere, but it was an unbelievable.
Wow.
We had people hauling stuff up the bluffs. When you look at the pictures, everybody you know is in these pictures, and all ages. It was
the whole island.
It was phenomenal. So we did do that.
I hope you can send me some of those pictures.
I have. Well, of course, they're not digital.
No, but you can take a picture of a picture and send it to me. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
I'd love that.
Yeah. So we did that, and then that's continued, not necessarily under the, because now there's the one that Kim Gaffett and Washington Trust sponsors. Kim Gaffett organizes, so that's under different auspices. But we did that successfully for any number of years.
Wow. Yeah, it is amazing. We had a guest on who spent, her name Sarah Callen from the Mystic Aquarium, and she did a 7-month stint or something like that on this little island out in the middle of nowhere, like by one of the atolls or something.
Yeah.
And she said it was amazing how much trash washed up.
Well, they were near the big garbage patch, the floating 2 miles.
She said it was just terrible.
So
there was not another human in sight,
right,
except for the other person or people working with her. But she just said it was terrible. Like, it was so hard, and you know.
literally in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the ocean.
And the refrigerator would wash up.
Yeah, just stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
It's crazy how much trash is out there.
Yeah, it's bad.
So were you always ecologically minded since you were a kid, or do you think, or did it like some, was it, did Block Island have something to do with
it? I think Block Island had everything to do with
everything
it. Which isn't to say that if I didn't have Block Island, I wouldn't care about the environment, but,
right.
But my sensibility is definitely place-based.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well,
wow.
I think it's an education for us because here you just see it up close. You see the effect that caring has and change, like you've made change, and everybody sees that, you know. It's good to hear this podcast on and remind people how dirty New Harbor was at one point, you know.
Yeah.
Great Salt Pond.
Yeah.
So it's really
And so, I guess everyone, when people think about the pond and the battle, Champlin's is the one that comes to mind, right? But you said that's been going on for 18 years. It's still right. going on.
It's still going
even
on.
Even with the new owners.
We thought we were, that's a funky situation.
Uh-huh.
But we were supposed to have a decision by June-ish. And then we heard through the vine that it's been punted to the fall. And we don't know through the tea leaves if that's good or bad.
Right.
But we have won, I think, 7 times on the agency level, CRMC level, and the courts at different junctures because Champlin's has continued to file motions and side, you know, sort of digressions and tangents from the... But we have won every single step of the way. And so, the hideous irony is if we lose this one, this is it. So it would be really perverse if we got to this stage, having won every stage along the way and lost. It would be. I frankly can't even.
Yeah,
imagine.
Yeah. It's tough to wrap your head around after doing all that work.
Like getting kicked out of high school in senior year.
Yeah, like the last.
Come on,
like
the last day of school.
And when you've done nothing but follow the rules.
Yeah,
right.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Wow. So, dumb it down for us. How do you so the process? Why 7? This is the 8th.
Okay. So
time like
Basically, Champlin's filed an application to expand their dock, we thought to some grotesque degree, that would encroach on the existing mooring fields, that would encroach on the fairways that run right in front of it, and it would amount and is a taking of public land.
Yeah.
And furthermore, CRMC requires that if even an expansion is granted, one must explore within the footprint of their own existence as it is now. And so they have that area to the west where they had the
bumper boats
and such.
Yeah.
So that they didn't explore that. And so there are many other, you know, if they had a more moderate proposal, if they used their existing footprint, all of that stuff. So they went headlong with this big proposal and it went to CRMC and there was a very dramatic night. We had packed the room and they were taking a vote and it came down to one vote as to whether it was gaveled through right then and there or whether it went to subcommittee. And we barely made it to subcommittee and that commenced a series of hearings that went on and on and on that, you know, where we put on evidence about shellfishing impact and water impact, navigational impact. Just expert after expert, they of course did the same. And we had all sorts of legal snafus along the way and ultimately they were denied. And I'm oversimplifying. There's a lot of drama in there.
Yeah.
They wanted to modify or some panel members wanted to modify. And of course some of the CRMC members had transitioned, you know, terms had expired. It's gone on so long, you know, so every time you started with a new cast of characters, they had to read this voluminous record. It was just, and then when you want to appeal an agency decision, you appeal to court. But when you appeal an agency decision, whether it's a CRMC or any other agency, you can only appeal within the confines of that. You can't throw a new issue or a new, it's a very limited review. It's not a de novo or what we call a commencing from the beginning, right? So there was some argument about what gets included in there. Somewhere along the way, Payne's put in an application for an expansion, which was very modest. And the parties that objected to Champlin's didn't object to that. So they had a fit that they had disparate treatment and that got reverted back down to demonstrate why they didn't have, you know, disparate treatment. And even though there was no subcommittee hearing on Payne's, we kind of inadvertently ended up having to put Pains through a subcommittee process, if only to compare it to how it wasn't like Chamblin.
Right, right. So right. Treating was, the kids equally.
Right, yeah. So yeah. It went on and on and on. So anyway, so then we won again, and then we won again. And then most recently, all of a sudden, there was literally a backroom deal.
Yeah, that was what, a year ago? Last year?
It was coming up on 2 years ago, I think. Right. And so that's where we are now, is objecting to the fact that we weren't at the table, and they're saying we were invited, we opted not to go. We said, yeah, no, not so much. We weren't properly noticed. They noticed someone other than Dan Prentice, our attorney. They noticed Kathy Marola, the then town solicitor, who said to Dan, by the way, did you know there's this meeting? And Dan said, NFW and whatever. No, we declined to go, on the understanding.
NFW, is that a legal term?
Yes. On the understanding that if we declined, the parties declined to attend, that it would not pursue.
Yeah.
And so it did. And then we appealed that fact, and it got assigned to the judge who had previously written the 52-page, I think, opinion that we thought we were even raised a glass of champagne, never thinking that it would be premature. It was signed, sealed, delivered, absolutely shutting the case down. And then this backroom deal came. So when we appealed the backroom deal, we thought it was going to go to that judge. Indeed, she reached out and said, okay, first meeting on this is going to be at this day and time, only to find out that there were more backroom shenanigans whereby they switched the judge. To a judge, you know, not in conformance with the practice of the court. And it went to a new judge who said, it can stand. And so we have now appealed that. So what we're waiting for an opinion on is the whole kit and caboodle about whether or not the compromised backroom deal that was formulated without us, that shouldn't be...
Shouldn't even be part of the thing.
It shouldn't... There's also... I'm butchering this to some extent because there's so many nuances to it. But another nuance is that the courts and the agency can't have jurisdiction at the same time. It's one or the other. So it was no longer within the agency's jurisdiction because it was on appeal at court. So the agency can't just pluck it out of thin air and sit down and decide on a random day that we're going to find a compromise here. Because there was no motion for a compromise. That wasn't even a thing.
Yeah.
That ship had sailed a long time ago. They had the chance to modify.
That's what I was going to say, that the time had passed.
They had a chance to modify, and they didn't. And so the significance of that is, if you don't modify the original application and that application is denied, which it was a million times over, you have to start from the beginning and file a new application. So that application was dead, and the agency didn't have jurisdiction at the time when they saw fit to create this compromised outcome. So we think it's a no-brainer, but, you know,
but Rhode Island, but Providence.
Lobsters and mobsters.
So do you get now, when you see the backroom deal, which we all know that's what it was, do we know who the players were?
Oh, sure.
We
know that they were the CRMC members.
And do they get in the trouble? Lawyers. Does anything happen to them?
Well, no, because to their mind, they were, you know, doing a good thing and bringing an end to a long and tortured litigation,
and that's what they,
finding
they
a happy middle ground, right. And blah blah blah.
That's how they spin it.
Well,
or
yeah,
try to.
Yeah,
and that's how they feel that they thought.
Well,
they were
some doing. Some yeah. may feel that way. Yeah. Some may
have been convinced to feel that way.
Yeah. Convinced.
Yeah.
Cash envelopes, baby. Briefcases.
Well, I'm not going to go there. But you know,
do you think that? If, and you know, we don't have to get your opinion strongly on either side of this, but I foresee an upcoming fight that's going to involve a lot of agencies with the service of liquor at Ballard's because of what they claim to be there's a plat and lot. There's a, you know, plat and lot map, a lot, whatever. And that's, they are well beyond that. So there's going to be a battle about whose land is that.
Well, I was in the land trust for 12 years, and we fought this battle to the right of the building, which is the land trust land.
Yeah.
And which is filled with their dumpsters, and it's where
used
people
to be
go
able to walk
it's
down
where
there
people
to fish.
Go to vomit, you know, and it's really bad. And even for emergency access, you know, so the land trust fought that battle for a long time, and I'm not clear on. I mean, I have some ideas. I don't think I want to share with them, but I have shared with them in a kitchen cabinet kind of way with council members.
Yeah.
About some options for that area. That yeah, they're legal and they involve, you know.
Yeah.
Cojones. And
yeah.
And so I don't know, and we probably won't know till we see the composition of the council after this election to see what kind of, you know, backbone there is to take some of these moves. But I can tell you that John Brotherhood and I, way back when, advocated strongly for a Port Authority. And we advocated it, you know, as a means by which to take control of our own borders. And it would give us some kind of leverage. You know, the other alternatives, of course, which has long been contemplated and never done. Edie Blaine told me a story not so long ago about how that whole downtown area that is now the parking lot.
She told us.
The woman owned it, wanted to sell it for $10,000.
Yeah.
And it was too much money. Well, now it's really too much money, but how much is too much when we're going through what we're going through? So there are other things that one could do, which is to, you know, give a rate guarantee whereby Interstate gets a guaranteed amount. And we would regulate schedules, costs. So I'm making this up. So instead of charging whatever it costs to bring a car over and back, you know, you could raise that price, discourage cars from coming, meet whatever guaranteed payment you pledge to Interstate. But the town has more control over the frequency, the schedule, the freight charges, and all of that. So we just don't have any leverage, and it's pathetic, frankly. And so now we're trying to sort of retroactively gain leverage. And I know this is not entirely the Ballard situation, but they're all under the same topic, to my mind, that we've really, our enforcement capacity has been, you know, I think
we're letting private businesses, you know, basically overtake whatever they want down in certain areas. And
I think in some ways it's a positive thing in that we, you know, we're a lovely, quaint community that support each other and believe in good things and migratory birds. And, you know, just we're so lucky and so fortunate. And I just think that we have, to some extent, taken it for granted, and that we somewhat naively thought that our community sensibility was echoed or would be respected by others. But we're not in Kansas anymore.
And we were undiscovered for so long. Like nobody, like we were literally just talking to some other interviewees we had, and they didn't even know Block Island existed for so long, you know, for years. So.
But not only that, I think that for decades and decades, the private business owners sort of followed that same sentiment that you were speaking of about, you know, when it was Kansas.
Right.
And, you know, they were ethical in their decisions and what they did. And, you know, I have said that, you know, you watch the documentary with the guy who's got $100 million in his basement in cash from dealing cocaine, and he's still smuggling drugs. And you're like, why are you doing that? And you get people that get addicted to growing and making more at all costs. And suddenly that addiction, I think, overwhelms your sensibility of what you your sense of community and what you should be worrying
about. Well, it kind of takes us full circle to where I started when we were trying to value the benefit of keeping forestation and macaws rather than clear cutting it so that you had it and it could sustain itself forevermore. I mean, you know, I tried in the maybe early 90s, late 80s. There's Rocky Mountain Institute is a think tank that does all sorts of things. But one of the things they did, and they had on staff a core group of folks that would come to communities like ours, seasonal communities, but communities that had particular attributes that they wanted to preserve. Often they were tourist or seasonal communities, and look at and try to define from the business standpoint, from the vacationer standpoint, from the resident standpoint, how much is too much? What does sustainability look like? What sacrifices are you collectively willing to make to have what you have? And, you know, how many t-shirts are you willing to not sell to be able to have a lifestyle such as the one you have or that you desire? And so it's about community discussion, but it's also ends up sort of with a solution, like some hardcore parameters that you can then use to inform your zoning policy and your traffic, you know, pattern and your ferry, you know, schedule and all sorts of things that would impact whatever vision you have collectively arrived at for your community. And the town couldn't get there. I pitched it quite a number of times, and they couldn't see what we are now in, so as to be able to put in place then what we could have prevented for now.
And that so makes basically, me sad.
Yeah.
I told you so.
Well, I don't mean to sound like that.
No,
really
but
no, 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 no. But we don't mean that. But
no,
yeah,
but yeah. You know, it's like they should have listened. I mean, right?
Right. But there are always, you know, urgent issues and things in the here and now and, you know, limited budgets, limited attention span and all of that stuff. And you need the right, you know, makeup and composition and on the town. And there are competing forces, you know, there's the tourism council, there's the chamber, there's the business community as independent units. There's a lot that, you know, that... Yeah, there's the mopeds. There's a lot of things that mitigate against that kind of a dialogue. And to be honest, I'm not sure we could have it today.
Yeah.
Because of the divisiveness in the world generally, but also even in the community. So I don't know.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it does. It's like it's too simple to just say we all need to come together and sing kumbaya because we're all part of this community and hopefully everyone's going
to think through what are we doing here and what it, you know. What about this place drew us here and you know what can't we live without atmospherically and environmentally and you know and how do we foster that, how do we maintain that, what does it take, what kind of sacrifice does it take to have that and so I you know that's a hard dialogue to have. I think it would have been easier to have years ago. You know, this is now decades ago.
Well, it was a simpler explanation back then almost. I mean, let's face it. Not everybody is up to the challenge and ability to think that far ahead or to accept and understand that it is real. It's kind of like climate change. We're watching it happen. We're watching. Everybody knows. Yeah. Everybody knows. Everybody's talking about it, supposedly doing things about it. But come on, let's be real. We're just watching it change and no one's doing anything about it. And that's kind of, you know, and I just feel that sometimes in this community, this is a tough one to say without, I'm not trying to, I have no one in particular in mind, but just because enough people here like you to put you in a power position of town government or, you know, doesn't mean you're necessarily that person that can think, like you already lost me like a decade ago when you're talking about a decade ahead, but you didn't, you know what I mean? But I think it's hard to get people to think, you know, that far ahead. They're so worried about what's going on now. And the same thing with a lot of politicians, even in the big world. They're so worried, what can I do right now to get me reelected? Nobody's going to reelect me because I told them that I'm going to make things better 25, 30 years from now. You know, they just don't, they don't follow that pattern. It's all about what's going on right now, you know?
Immediacy. So how are you feeling about the Champlin's decision in your gut? Are you hopeful?
I'm always hopeful.
Yeah.
And it would just, I don't know. As I said earlier, I can't even wrap my mind around losing at this point in time. Not only because what a gross injustice I think it would be, given all of the wins along the way, and that I really truly believe that we have the more righteous position.
Well, yeah.
But not even from a political standpoint. I mean, it is unmistakably a public taking of land. And why would they be entitled to do that for private commercial gain is beyond me. And then on top of that, we've provided the evidence on the impacts on the pond, environmentally speaking and navigationally and so forth. So to me, it's an airtight, you know, so I can't intellectually imagine how we could go down. But then, of course, you know, my brokenheartedness about just what it would do to the pond and the precedent it would set. And the other thing I should tell you about this, as this has gone forward and as other communities have watched the twists and turns of the CRMC, i.e., I shouldn't say corruption, but the
backdoor deal.
The backdoor, you know, that's been alarming to them either because they've got applications pending or because they've experienced similar things. So one good thing that's come out of this already is that there was a referendum that passed in the State House about cleaning up the CRMC. So, you know, part of the legacy of this litigation and part of the ancillary impact of this is that CRMC is under scrutiny in a way they have never been.
Yeah.
So that bodes well for future fights. But, you know, we've engaged other communities in common cause for that. And that's, you know, and also, you know, folks like Save the Bay and the Conservation Law Foundation out of Boston, and they're a party to the litigation from the regulatory standpoint as well. So we've helped to, you know, kind of install some dignity and some propriety to that agency where heretofore there was little.
Yeah. I think, I mean, as a society in general, we're just all too used, just not comfortable with, but we're just used to corruption at this point. I feel like, and on all levels of government, I feel like it's just like it's so obvious, you know, the corporations, you know, and the lobbyists' influence and, you know, the money. It's just like, but I feel like a lot of us just kind of accept it. We're like, well, yeah, of course it's all corrupt, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there were some honest thinking people on the panel. I don't want to throw everyone, you know, under
the
bus.
No, I don't mean everyone.
But, you know, there were some things that were so obviously wrong. And even if, and I'm not suggesting, you know, graft and, you know, as you said before, like
cash envelopes.
But, you know, it's a back scratching exercise, a mutual reciprocity and people. I mean, Rhode Island is so small.
Yeah.
And the connectivity between, you know, the power brokers and the decision makers is incredible. Yeah. It's incredible.
Well, a friend of ours said it doesn't have to be an envelope of cash to be corruption. It can be
favors
or just a matter of
looking the other way.
Non-enforcement, you know, is another venue for that, you know.
But
man,
wow,
you've done some great work.
Yeah.
Well, have you?
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever thought about running for town council or doing?
I've thought about it. I mean, I've been, you know, flattered to be asked to do it, but I've still got a day job. And so it's kind of hard. You know, I have to be able to commit. I'm kind of an all in gal. So if I can't.
No.
You don't strike me as very intense. That's, you know.
Doesn't seem like, you know, focus and fire.
I'm like petrified throughout this entire interview.
I'm loving it.
I love it, but I'm like.
And I'm learning so much.
Why are
I'm learning
you petrified?
Well, not petrified, but you're intense, man.
Oh, sorry.
Like, no, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. That's why
I liked it. That's why I liked it.
Yeah, you don't strike me as a daydreamer.
I'm glad you're on
like you're more like a like.
I'm glad you're on what I would call the good guys team. That's how you know what I mean. That's
me
it.
Me too.
I like it.
Well, I mean, you know, when you're inspired and you enjoy it, I put in time and on the BIC as well for a long time in the land trust and. So they all come together and they're it's just really enjoyable work. So yeah. I'm happy to do it. But the council, I think if I didn't have a day job, I'd consider it. Where if I knew I wouldn't be traveling or and I could make all the meetings and stuff. But
there's
land trust was sort of once a month on Monday with work in between, and it was very predictable and manageable.
Yeah.
But BIC.
I think you're basically saying if I can't do it right, I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
If the time comes where I can do it right,
I'd consider doing it.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, let me tell you, this is a story from Blue Apron to caring so much. She was a Blue Apron, right? You were a Blue Apron. The other girls were pink aprons.
They were pink.
From Blue Apron to, you know, this, where you care so much about Block Island.
This level of involvement in the community.
Doing so much. I didn't even know how much you were doing for me. And now I
didn't either.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, really. You're so welcome. I'm embarrassed, but thank you.
Well,
I mean,
you shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to thank me. There's so many people.
We thank them all and anybody that's helped you on the way.
Anyone who's on the
we're just used to not being the smartest people in the room.
Yeah, we're so, we're so comfortable being
it's no biggie.
Idiots, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We try to keep our combined IQs.
Yeah, under 100.
Yeah.
Probably under 50.
Man.
I don't even know what's a good IQ. That's how stupid I am.
I was going to say,
I don't know either.
I was just going to ask that.
I was going to take a test, but I couldn't figure out how to find one.
I would wager this, though. Yours is more than ours combined.
Drive is better than mine. I can tell you that much.
Yeah.
But
no doubt.
I'm still
my head's spinning.
Full circle from being the first female bartender they wanted to put behind the bar at Dead Eyes and looking out at that pond.
Right.
And then years and years later, fighting to keep it what it was back in those days. You know? I've got home movies of my dad, letting go of the ski rope and riding up onto the beach in front of Dead Eyes right there. That's where they would, that's how wide open it was. You'd come ripping at Dead Eyes with the boat, you'd bang a hard left, and whoever's on the skis would let go. And
just,
we got one of my uncle, and I don't know if he listens or not, but.
Who, Peter?
Uncle Pete. And you just watch him come right out of the skis and go, the camera, it was one of those ones the camera goes down because you know he went head first into that rock wall there.
Well, that would explain a lot.
And I think he was yelling at my, he'll probably scold me if I got this wrong. I think they were not bringing him in fast enough. So he kept sinking in the water.
Oh, so it wasn't his fault, in other words.
Yeah. So he was like, got to get me closer. Got to get me faster. Because he was, he'd kind of come in and then he'd like land in like waist deep. And he wanted to get right up there. And I think it might have been my dad. I was like, I'll get him
closer.
All right,
I'll get you up there. Oh, wow. Man.
Oh, my. Crazy. Well, where are we for time?
We're there.
Yeah. Should we, would you be disappointed if we said that's a great podcast?
No, I'd be happy and fine with that.
Well, I think that's a great podcast.
It's going to take me a bit to think about
this. Is going to be top on my list. I can't wait to listen to it because doing it is one thing. It's like, you know, somebody said it to me, one of our listeners said it's like, it's playing in a sports game, and it's one thing to be in there, but when you go home and watch the video of you playing in the sports game, it's different. And that's what podcast seems like to me. Like, it's like listening to it for the first time when it's done and edited and I listen to it, you know?
Right.
But thank you so much. Yeah. Claire,
thank you so much. I'm so honored to have been asked. So I appreciate
it. Wonderful.
Would you come back and talk with us again maybe at some point?
Yeah. When we win champions, I'd be
happy to. I'm talking about.
Well, right, and cool. Who knows what the timeline is, because as you know, we record a few in advance. So by the time you hear this, there may already be a decision in champions, but who knows? Cause we know how long it's going to take.
Yeah.
I'd love to have Claire back. That'd be so much fun. Yeah.
That'd be excellent.
All right. Well, listeners, that's about it for this episode. And thank you for listening to us and supporting our sponsors. And if you want to reach out with any questions, comments, or ideas, please do so at twoguysonbi@gmail.com.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And wherever you listen to the podcast, please hit the subscribe button. And most importantly, just tell your friends about it.
Yeah. Share it.
Share.
We appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again to Claire. And I guess we'll see you next week.
See you next week. Okay. Thanks.
See ya. Hey, Rich.
Yeah?
I'm thinking about going to law school. Would you help me study?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
Do you know what, like, books I should start reading?
I know they're heavy.
Yeah.
So you might want to start with, like, a workout routine.
Okay.
And then go get the books.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
All right, so gym membership first, then law school.
Right.
Got
it. That's it. Gold's Gym, then... Oh, I tell you what.